I call this meeting of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting, holding remote hearings pursuant to Rule 10.01. And with that, we'll start with the roll. Anna, please go ahead.
Chair Becker Finn.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feist.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny.
Present.
Representative Fart.
Present.
Representative Robbins. Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
All right, a quorum is present. First, we will move the minutes from January 28th. Let's see, Representative Herr, you have your screen, your video on. So would you move the minutes, Representative Herr?
So moved.
All right, thank you. Representative Herr moves the minutes for January 28th, 2021. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved. We have three bills on the agenda today. We actually have our first bill up from someone who is not on this committee. So the first bill on our agenda this morning is House File 269 from Representative Morrison. Representative Morrison, welcome to our committee. And let's see. I will move that House File 269 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Oh, actually, I think we're moving this to the General Register. I changed my motion. So the motion will be that House File 269 be referred to the General Register. Representative Morrison, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I believe you are correct initially that it is going to Ways and Means.
Okay. Sorry, my notes were from two different days. So the motion, I will amend my motion, and the motion is that House File 269 be sent to Ways and Means. Sorry about that, Representative Morrison. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, House File 269 is a bill to allow Minnesota to join the Psychology Interjurisdictional Compact, or PSIPACT, which is an interstate compact that facilitates the practice of psychology using telecommunications technologies and or temporary in-person face-to-face psychological practice. The benefits of PSIPACT are several, and they include increasing access to care by providing services to populations that are currently underserved or geographically isolated, facilitating continuity of care when a patient relocates or travels. It also certifies that psychologists submit acceptable standards of practice. It promotes cooperation among PSIPACT states in the areas of regulation and licensure. It offers a higher degree of consumer protection across state lines, and it decreases logistical burden on psychologists by allowing licensed psychologists to practice telepsychology and or conduct temporary in-person face-to-face practice across state lines without having to become licensed in additional PSIPACT states. So far, I believe 15 states have joined PSIPACT and 12 others have pending legislation. This bill has bipartisan support, and I particularly want to thank Senator Benson for carrying the bill in the Senate. And I do have two testifiers this morning, Dr. Tricia Stark, who's a practicing psychologist and chair of the Minnesota Psychological Association Legislative Committee, and Sam Sands, who is the executive director of the Board of Psychology.
All right, we can go ahead with your first testifier. Please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, my name is Dr. Tricia Stark. I'm a psychologist
and chair of the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota Psychological Association. Thanks for the opportunity to present about House File 269 or SIPACT. It's an interjurisdictional compact that would allow Minnesota psychologists who meet the national requirements to provide services using telehealth and limited in-person visits in other SIPACT states in order to manage state-based licensing restrictions. Currently, SIPACT has been passed, I think it's been passed in one more state. It's now in 16, and it's pending legislation in others, including Minnesota. It is the national standard for providing safe psychological services across state lines using telehealth. SIPACT is important for three reasons. It allows for continuity of care. It increases access to psychology services in underserved parts of our state by providers in other SIPACT states, and it provides for protection of the public good. An example of the use of SIPACT is college students who are not physically in Minnesota, but have longstanding therapeutic relationships with the provider here. SIPACT would allow the Minnesota psychologist to continue to follow the patient and facilitate any transfer of care that is needed. Access to care is a challenge in Minnesota, and by joining this compact, psychologists from other SIPACT states can provide services here. All psychologists practicing through SIPACT must be aware of local resources should an emergency arise and be culturally competent to provide care to the specific population they are serving. Such standards are crucial to the protection of Minnesotans. Please support SIPACT because it enables continuity of care and increases access to care while protecting the public with the highest national standards.
Thank you, Dr. Stark. Representative Morrison, I think we'll go to your next testifier, and then we can take questions after we have testimony. So the next testifier I have on the list is Sam Sands. I don't know if Sam could introduce themselves for the record and what organization they're with, and then go forward with their testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I am Sam Sands. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Psychology, and I'm testifying in support, the board's support of HF, House File 269. I'll keep my comments brief out of respect for the committee's time, but I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have for me. First off, the board's mission is to protect the public through licensure, regulation, and education to promote access to safe, competent, and ethical psychological services. SIPACT meets the board's mission on all fours, on all respects of what we try to do for the residents of the state. SIPACT is an interstate compact that's created in partnership with the Council of State Governments National Center for Interstate Compacts, which helps states meet the mental health needs of their residents. It's a general compact language for the most part that allows the psychologists to provide telehealth services across state lines. The Council of State Governments has worked to enter into compacts for the last 40 plus years. 16 states have already adopted the language proposed. As a compact, the language cannot be altered. We need to adopt the interstate compact the way that it is written. So let me just talk about a few ways that this supports the board's mission. It protects the public. It allows competent psychologists to practice into the state via telepsychology. Currently, we allow a licensed psychologist in another state to practice into the state for 30 days without becoming licensed in Minnesota. But individuals with an e-passport would be granted, through SIPACT would have additional vetting, and the board can monitor exactly who is practicing in the state, whereas we don't always have the visibility for people that are practicing under that threshold of 30 days. It increases access to care, as Dr. Stark mentioned. The continuity of care is also a benefit of the PSYCPACT. It allows for a business person to travel into Minnesota and receive services from their psychologist from a different state that is a member of the that it has an e-passport from a PSYCPACT jurisdiction. The legislation provides mechanisms for the board to expel or discipline psychologists practicing in Minnesota without a license. Currently, the board has the ability to seek an injunction against somebody practicing psychology, but PSYCPACT does expand our ability to regulate and ensure that there are competent psychologists providing services into Minnesota. Minnesota, we would be able to revoke somebody's authority to practice telehealth into Minnesota. And additionally, the commission would be able to revoke the e-passport for that psychologist so they can't practice in any compact state. In addition, this will encourage the compact states to enhance their work related to disciplinary issues, which is the final benefit that I'll mention of this. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
And we will take, we have one more testifier on the list, but I'm gonna take a question here from Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to just speak to the positivity of this bill, and I'm so glad to see it coming forward. We all know there's a shortage of and waiting list many times for mental health services. And so to the extent that we can make folks have more access to that sort of help, I think this is a real positive. And so I just wanted to thank Representative Morrison for bringing the bill. I think it's important. It's going to help a lot of people. And thanks for the testifiers for being here. That's really all I wanted to say.
Those kinds of comments are fine too, Representative Scott. So thank you for weighing in. And with that, we will get to the last testifier I have on the list is Joel Carlson. Mr. Carlson, if you want to introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Well, good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice. And before I get into the meat of the bill, I just wanted to make a couple comments so that members know this is my first flight in front of your committee, and our association has testified dozens of times in front of the judiciary and civil law committees as it relates to uniform laws, interstate compacts, and immunity. This isn't anything new for us, and I wanted to make sure that new members to the committee know that we didn't just appear here because we didn't like this particular interstate compact. We haven't caught them all, but we've testified dozens of times on these types of issues. And I want the members to also know that our association does not oppose the compact and the concept and the benefits that it can bring. Our concerns are not related to the inconvenience of a lawyer having to file a case in state court versus federal court, as I've read from some of the opponents. Our concerns are about the broad and expansive immunity in this bill, the rulemaking in this bill, and how Minnesotans would have redress if something goes wrong. And I will point out, and I know, as you can tell by my hair, I've been around a while. You absolutely can amend these bills. The compact contemplates that states can amend it. As I've done my research, I see at least four states that have made individual amendments. They've not been huge, but this is an amendable bill. You didn't give up your election certificate and not be able to protect Minnesotans the way you think is appropriate. On its face, the legislation transfers a lot of licensing and regulatory authority to this commission. It's a meaty bill. It's 26 pages long. I want you to know that some of the definitions that talk about what they can do and the data that they can collect are appropriate. But when we get to later parts in the bill, they give us some concern. This commission can collect FBI reports, public and non-public data on practitioners, fingerprints, arrest data, complaints over patient care, all of health records that go along with patient care, and they have the ability to make rules that have the force and effect of law. At Article 7 on page 11, it outlines what this commission can do with an adverse outcome. And while I think that is all appropriate, there's a provision in there that isn't defined and I wonder about, and that has to do with what they call an alternative program for a practitioner who, in lieu of an adverse action being taken against them, can enter into an alternative program and avoid an adverse action. And that is not public data. And that is on lines 12.11. This bill also removes the right of a psychologist to have any judicial or administrative remedy that is subject to an adverse action from the commissions. So those are some of the definitional issues that, you know, we need to understand. But the meat of the bill for us starts on Article 10 on page 14. And this is where the compact, and I haven't seen this in other uniform compacts, grants onto itself venue and jurisdiction into whatever state they choose to locate their offices, as opposed to our more common rules of venue and jurisdiction being, you know, where the defendant was, you know, where the injury occurred. This says if you have an issue, you got to file it in Georgia or wherever they decide to have their office, and you're subject to their laws in that state. And I just haven't seen that in other uniform compacts. This commission can close its meetings to the public, and they can keep their records of their closed meetings under seal and only opened by a court order under line 16.6. They can set their own personnel rules, and they can set the amount that they assess each state for their services, and they can hold you accountable if you don't pay up. Of particular importance is that on page 19 and 20, the commission members and their employees are immune from liability for their negligent acts, and that is more protection than we give to any governmental entity in the state of Minnesota. It applies to breach of data. It applies to auto accidents, workplace harassment. Anything that this commission does, they are immune from their negligent acts, and we think that that sets the bar too high. I'm almost done, Madam Chair. And Article 11 provides rulemaking for this commission, including emergency rulemaking authority that has the force and effect of law that they can adopt without notice, opportunity for comment or hearing. And they can do that if they believe there is an imminent threat to public health or safety, or simply to protect the public health and safety. These emergency rules are in place for 90 days without any ability to challenge them. And I haven't seen that in any other uniform compact, and that is broad and sweeping authority that a commission of appointed officials can make emergency law that it has effect in Minnesota for up to 90 days without our ability to challenge that action. The legislature can repeal a rule, but if you're not in session, you have no ability to address these emergency rules. So, Madam Chair and members, we support what they're trying to do here. We point these out because we have seen these uniform acts and compacts become more and more common. And I think it's important that the legislature knows what they're buying when they get into these, because at some point there is going to be a problem, and you really are taking away, with approval of this the way it's written, rights of Minnesotans to their redress and to their day in court. And we think that just goes too far. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson, for your testimony. First on the list is Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair. And Mr. Carlson, thank you for your close attention to this. And this is what the committee process is for. And I'm just going to ask about one little piece of something you mentioned. Actually, I'm going to maybe address this to Mr. Sands, because you mentioned about if a psychologist gets into trouble, there's a provision that they can have some kind of alternative arrangement to deal with it that's not public. And Mr. Sands, my understanding is that in Minnesota, we have something similar for health practitioners who, you know, have an addiction problem or have some kind of impairment. Is this, could you kind of describe how this compares to that? Are we doing something that's new and unusual here, or is this kind of just an extension of what we do in Minnesota already?
Mr. Sands.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I believe that you're correct, Representative Liebling, that this discussion of alternative to discipline is what we refer to as the HPSP program, which is the healthcare health provider services program, which allows for a diversion from disciplinary measures into a treatment model and a monitoring model of either substance use issue or a mental impairment that a licensee is able to enter into in lieu of discipline with the board to make sure that their issue is monitored and the public is protected. So yes, I think that I believe that this alternative measure is the same thing that we do through our HPSP program.
Any follow-up? Yep, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'd like to address the same thing to Mr. Carlson. I don't know if you're familiar with the HPSP program, but do you view this as broader in the compact than what we already do in Minnesota as far as, you know, I get the concern about shielding people from, you know, some wrongdoer and suddenly nobody could see what it was and we don't know that somebody's, you know, I get that concern, but we kind of deal with that in a balanced way in Minnesota already. Is this compact doing something more than that?
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Liebling, you've kind of hit on one of my concerns about these compacts. I may have confidence in our State Board of Psychology and how they handle something, but this group can write their own rules about how they do it, number one, and all of the other compacting states can write their rules about how they want to handle these alternative in lieu of adverse action events. So I am certainly aware of how we handle sensitive health-related issues, and I understand that, and we don't oppose that. We are transferring our ability to regulate that to every other compacting state and to this commission. And that is the point that I'm trying to make, because you may have a state that has serious problems that we would not at all want to keep private that some other state might. And that's the question that I raise.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Next, we'll go to Representative Johnson, and then after that, Representative Moeller. So, Representative Johnson.
Chair members, I understand the need for this bill, but I have, after listening to Mr. Carlson, I have some real concerns with the points that he brought up. And I know this has been fast-tracked because of some issues that's going on at the federal level. Something like this, I think we need to take a deep dive in it to make sure we do it right to protect the citizens of Minnesota. So I'm not going to be able to vote for it at this time, but I want to. But we have to make sure when we do this, we do it right.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. I will note it is going to Ways and Means next, and you know, certainly it's good to have discussion of all of the issues. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank Representative Morrison for bringing this bill. I think it's extremely important. I've heard from a number of constituents about the importance of this, including one who is a college student living in another state attending college, and that student needed to access their psychologist back in Minnesota with whom they had a relationship for over a decade and were unable to have that conversation and have that treatment from their Minnesota psychologist because of this. And this bill is a life-saving bill. And I can certainly understand Mr. Carlson's concerns about this, but I do wonder about a couple of the provisions that he cited, Madam Chair, and I'd just like to ask a question about at least one of those. And Mr. Carlson, that's related to the qualified immunity provision starting on line 19.29. And it's my understanding that the immunity here is for the commission itself, not for individual psychologists, so that if a patient had a cause of action against a psychologist, they could still bring that, that this immunity is just for the commission. And if you could address that, please, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Moeller. If your cause of action happens to be against the commission for negligent credentialing or for some other cause of action that the commission itself has adopted, they are immune from liability. This also gives immunity to their employees and the commission members for a limited immunity. This is immunity for even their negligent acts. And if you really read on page 19, they even get the higher benefits of saying if they believed they were doing the right thing. So you have that added burden that they get to assert whether or not they thought they were doing the right thing. So I think that this does apply to an individual that may be harmed by an action of or inaction of the commission. We have seen this with the Adult Parole Board where they have had negligent supervision. And so it does happen where the action of these compact commissions do give rise to causes of action. And so I don't think it's just limited to the staff or the commission itself, the way it's written as I read it.
Representative Moeller.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. But I still, don't see that there's immunity for the individual practitioner, the psychologist, with this provision. So, I guess.
Sorry.
Representative Moeller has the floor.
Yep. So, Mr. Carlson, maybe you and I can talk about that offline too, but that's certainly not how I'm reading the bill. And I'll just say too that, I know you had mentioned at the beginning of your comments that you thought this could be amended. And I'm really concerned about all the different things you mentioned now. You're essentially wanting to rewrite perhaps this entire compact. And so that concerns me too. If there's a way for it to be amended, that should definitely be considered. But at some point I don't even know if that's possible, but even if it is, at some point we're talking about rewriting this compact with other states. And I'm happy to have further conversations with you offline about this bill. It's very important to me and I'm happy to work on it more.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. And next we'll have Representative Robbins and then Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to echo sort of what Representative Moeller was just talking about and Representative Johnson previously. I'm surprised we didn't learn more about this or that amendments weren't brought forward. And so I think this is an important bill, but I want to make sure we get it right. And so I probably won't be supporting it at this time, but I really would be happy to also work on it and encourage Mr. Carlson and others who have concerns to bring forth language that they would suggest and see if we can work that out. I get it's a compact and there's probably very narrow bands, but if we are able to amend it, I would want to consider that. And I just wondered, Representative Morrison, if you could just address some of these concerns and how you're feeling about, is there room to amend it? If you could just share with us your thoughts on all of this. Thank you.
Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Robbins. This compact has passed in, I thought it was 15, but I guess it's 16 other states with really no opposition. And this bill has been around for the better part of a year here. And we had heard of no opposition from anyone until this past weekend. And so I remain a little surprised by the breadth of the concerns. I'm, of course, open to, and I told Mr. Carlson this, open to working with him to see if we can find common ground. But I am really, we are in the middle, we were in the middle of a mental health crisis before the pandemic began, and it has only accelerated. It is so important that we find common sense ways to increase access to mental health services in Minnesota and across the country, frankly. And so I am really hopeful that we are able to get this, to get, to help Minnesota join SciPact.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. Next, we have Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought Representative Robbins was before me. Okay. My question is to Mr. Sands. I was curious about the scale of the issues that Mr. Carlson is raising, because they do resonate with me, but I also understand, especially in light of what Representative Morrison just said, the scale of the mental health crisis we're facing and the benefit that this would do. And so I would just like to hear from Mr. Sands, his perspectives on, you know, the benefit versus the risk, and whether there is a really massive problem that we have here that we would need to address before we could proceed. Thank you.
Mr. Sands.
Madam Chair, Representative Feist, thank you for the opportunity to talk about the mental health issues that we face here in providing services in Minnesota. I mean, we were in a mental health crisis prior to the COVID, the pandemic, and that crisis has only been exacerbated at this point. As far as a cost-benefit analysis, you know, what this allows is for a vetted psychologist who is licensed and in good standing in another state that has no disciplinary action to provide services that they're competent to provide via telehealth means to Minnesotans. It allows for the board to take an active role in protecting the public from any services provided by those psychologists that falls below the standard of care that we expect for psychologists here in Minnesota. As far as, you know, the immunity provisions related to the bill and some of the standard, some of the compact itself language, I would note that the medical compact has very similar immunity standards in that language that was passed in 2015. I think that the benefits of this are increased visibility to who's practicing in Minnesota, the ability to stronger regulatory protections for Minnesotans who want to make a complaint, who feel that they haven't had competent care provided by a psychologist, and also the ability for the board to take actions that, you know, either alert different boards that for e-passport holders in other states who are providing services into Minnesota, to take additional actions that you know, we might not have been able to take. It really does provide a more encompassing regulatory framework for licensees, and it doesn't detract from our ability to take disciplinary actions for Minnesota licensees, and to regulate the profession here in the state.
Any follow-up, Representative Feist?
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. We've got Representative Liebling, and then we will try to get to the vote.
Okay, Madam Chair, thanks for calling on me again. You know, I just wanted to sort of address the rush aspect of this. A question that I have, I was under the impression, and maybe I'm wrong, that during the pandemic, the governor had waived the some of the licensing requirements for out-of-state treatment by executive order. And maybe, you know, I don't know if anyone on this call, maybe Mr. Sands, you must know whether that in fact is the case. So, you know, there was a big push during special session for this bill to be put through during special session. And I have to say that I personally was not urging that to happen. It wasn't my call. It would have been the Health Policy Committee. But I was concerned because compacts are a big deal. This is a big bill. There's a lot here. And the push was because they needed to, you know, there was this, the CARES Act money was available for psychologists to be able to have their fees waived under this if we were, did it by a certain deadline. And then the deadline was extended. So, and so just to say that normally we wouldn't have taken up this kind of a bill this year at all in the health space, right? Because we're not doing scope of practice or licensing or these kinds of things this year, except sort of for the urgency of it. So the urgency has been around needing to do, you know, I totally understand and am very sympathetic to the need for the services across the lines, especially during the pandemic. So that's been sort of the driving force behind this to move it more quickly. But that's why I'm asking, do we right now have the ability to have this cross-border telehealth thing going on? So what is the urgency right now? Is it still the $400 fee, or is it the need for service, or exactly what? Because I think the committee has a lot to wrestle with, and we need to understand how fast we really do need to make this decision. If Mr. Sands could address that.
Mr. Sands.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, thank you for the opportunity to respond. As of right now, Executive Order 2028 does allow for licensed providers to provide teleservices into the state with a license, a psychology license in a different state. I would say that that is an imperfect way of regulating. There's not the ability to take action in the way that there is under SciPact. Essentially what the board is doing right now is acknowledging that somebody is providing services into the state. However, under SciPact, we would have additional regulatory tools at our disposal that would be more in line with what we have for our own licensees versus what we have under the executive order. I think that the governor, you know, his office passed this EO in an attempt to rise to this occasion, to rise to the challenge for mental health providers. We're one of four boards that is engaged in this executive order. But I think SciPact would be a definite step in the right direction in terms of regulatory policy for these professions.
So, great. Madam Chair, just to close the loop.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm understanding that while, you know, many people feel this would be much better than what we have now, and I grant you that, we are right now able to, you know, some of the situations that have been discussed, people are able to continue with their psychologist across the border and so on, is what I'm understanding. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Scott, and then we will move to the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this is a question for the author or one of the testifiers, but my understanding is that for individual psychologists in Minnesota, joining this compact is voluntary, and I just wanted to verify that, if that is accurate.
Representative Morrison.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, that is correct.
All right, Representative Scott, was that your, okay, thank you.
I'm good, thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Scott. There were no amendments filed to this bill, so we will move forward. I renew my motion that House File 269 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Anna, please go forward with the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Weiss.
Aye.
Representative Frazier?
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excuse. Representative Herr?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen? Representative Novotny?
Aye.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Got it.
Representative Mortensen, I think, had not answered initially.
Representative Mortensen?
All right, go ahead, Anna.
Right.
I have 12 ayes, 3 nays, and 1 abstain.
All right. Thank you. With that, the motion prevails. House File 269 is re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, members. I think that was a good discussion and a good example of the kinds of things we get to discuss in this committee. So thank you, Representative Morrison, for coming to our committee. And with that, we'll move on to the next bill on the agenda, which is House File 279, Uniform Probate Code Harmless Error Provision. This is a Representative Long bill. Representative Long, would you like to move House File 279 to be moved to the General Register?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that is my motion.
All right. Thank you, Representative Long. Moves the bill. Please tell us about your bill, Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill deals with harmless errors in the context of wills, where a will has been completed, but there has been some error in its execution. And in these situations, when the wishes of the decedent can be clearly established, it is good policy to try to achieve that intent. This bill would extend the approach we have taken temporarily during the pandemic for wills and make it permanent. If a testator's intent can be shown by clear and convincing evidence, which is a high burden to overcome, then the will can be deemed properly executed. This approach has been adopted by at least 9 other states using language from the Uniform Probate Code. And I'd like to ask Brian Lake from the Minnesota State Bar Association to speak to the practitioner's perspective.
All right, Mr. Lake, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to Representative Long for his leadership on this. And my name is Brian Lake. I'm representing the Minnesota State Bar Association. And I think Representative Long gave a good overview of what we got in front of the committee today. And I just wanted to fill in a little more background and details for you. So this is actually kind of an imported concept. It arose first in Australia in the mid 70s and then was picked up in Israel and some other countries. And when the Uniform Law Commissioners saw how effective the harmless error rule was at eliminating unnecessary litigation in those countries, they added it to the Uniform Probate Code here. And as Representative Long mentioned, it has been picked up in at least 9 other states. I actually learned over the weekend, I think it's now 10 other states. So essentially what the harmless error rule does is it allows a will to be probated even if there's a technical defect with the signing or witnessing requirements that we have in statute. So some common examples that have arisen in other states that have this have been spouses accidentally signing each other's wills, maybe having only one witness instead of two, or maybe the testator or the witnesses signed on the wrong line. And these are the kind of errors that can be corrected by the court. Now, Madam Chair, there's 2 things that I think are really important for the committee to know. And the first is that this law does not take away the signing and witnessing requirements that we have in statute. It simply allows the court to overlook those technical errors if there is clear and convincing evidence that the testator intended the document to be their will. And as Representative Long mentioned, that's a pretty high bar to clear. That is a considerably tougher standard than a preponderance of the evidence. So it's a tough standard to meet. And then the second thing committee members should know is what this does, this particular law, is it aligns how errors are dealt with by the probate court with other types of errors that the probate court deals with. So the errors that we're talking about with this particular law are execution errors or signing and witnessing errors. Probate courts already use the exact same evidentiary standard to evaluate and deal with other types of mistakes that they see. So if there's like a failure to revoke a will, they can fix that if there's clear and convincing evidence of the testator's intent. If there's a drafting error in a will or trust, they can fix that if there's clear and convincing evidence of a testator's intent. And if there's an error with like what we call a non-probate transfer instrument, so these are instruments like a transfer on death deed or a beneficiary designation in an IRA or a life insurance policy, things like that where assets are transferred outside of a will. If there's errors in those documents, the court, again, can correct that if there's clear and convincing evidence of the testator's intent. So without the harmless error rule, we can have some absurd results where the exact same assets will pass according to the decedent's wishes or not, depending on the type of error and the type of instrument that's used. So, for example, the average person, their estate will consist of a house, maybe a checking and savings account, like a retirement account, a 401k or IRA, and potentially a life insurance policy. Now, all of those assets can be transferred using non-probate transfer instruments. So, you know, a transfer on death deed for a house, pay on death designation for bank accounts, beneficiary designations for retirement policies or life insurance, and all of those instruments don't require any witnessing and they have far fewer formalities than a will does. So if people use those instruments, harmless error rules are relevant, and all of the mistakes on those kind of documents can be fixed by the court. If there's a mistake inside of a will, if they use a will to transfer those assets, or a trust, and there's a mistake inside either one of those instruments, the court can correct it if there's clear and convincing evidence. What we're doing here with this law is kind of fixing the final piece, which is if there's an execution error in a will, the court can again correct that with clear and convincing evidence. So I think when you're thinking about why you should pass this bill, I would think about the opposite, what happens if you don't. So if the law is allowed to sunset, what's going to happen is that even if there's clear evidence of the decedent's intention and there's no objection from any interested party, a technical execution defect is still going to be a fatal flaw. And in those cases, the decedent's assets are going to be distributed according to Minnesota's intestacy statute. So that will kind of dictate what happens to the assets, even if it's completely contrary to the clear wishes of the decedents. So, Madam Chair, in our view, you know, the harmless error rule leads to fair and more consistent treatment. It aligns with how the probate code treats other types of errors. It allows courts to salvage, you know, what will be otherwise good wills if there is a clear and convincing evidence of the testator's intentions. And we think it produces more just results while still protecting the integrity of the probate system. And Madam Chair, the last thing I would say is I think this is really good for regular people, especially those who can't afford to work with lawyers or choose not to. You know, we think if there, you know, there are a lot of folks out there drafting their own documents, taking care of execution themselves, mistakes happen and they happen, you know, more frequently than you might imagine. I guess in our view, we think if the intent is obvious and there's very strong evidence to support it, the decedent's wishes should not be disregarded just because they tripped over some kind of technical execution requirement. So with that, Madam Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, I don't have any other testifiers on the list, so we'll go to Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, and Mr. Lake. I do have a question about this. I'm sympathetic to it. I think it makes sense. But my memory of this is we did this last spring to deal with the fact that in the COVID situation, there would be people in nursing homes who couldn't get the witness signatures. And we wanted to still allow their wills to be processed. And that's why the sunset date was on there. And my concern is that I'd like you to talk more in specificity, a hold harmless error, I get. They sign on the wrong line. They sign somewhere wrong. But what about if there's no witnesses? Are you still saying that's okay? Because I get the backstop is always the clear and convincing evidence line. but I'm very concerned that we did this for a very specific COVID reason, and now we're having no sunset, no further discussion of how witnesses will be handled. So in fact, if there are no witnesses, but there's clear and convincing evidence, that would now be allowed. Is that what we're saying here? Thank you.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll speak briefly to it, and I'm sure Mr. Lake will want to chime in. So the circumstances of the pandemic, I think, were persuasive for implementing this in a sort of emergency fashion, but I think it does also speak to the broader need for having a law like this, which is that we know there are instances that there will be errors, and the outcome, I think, from a public policy standpoint, is better to effectuate the intent of the decedent than not. So, I think it, there certainly were compelling circumstances around the pandemic, but I don't think the having the pandemic removed makes the policy any less compelling to achieve. And I'll let Mr. Lake speak to the question about signatures or witnesses, excuse me.
Thank you, Representative Long. Mr. Lake.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Robbins. And you are correct, this did arise during the pandemic, and I would say it was partially influenced by the pandemic. And now there's some other states that I think by executive order and other methods just temporarily eliminated witnessing requirements. In the Bar Association's view, that was, a far too aggressive approach and problematic approach. So what we brought to the legislature last year was something that could help deal with some of the pandemic issues with getting witnesses, but we wanted to bring something that we thought, and we said this last year, was not just a temporary patch, but something that we thought was a really good long-term permanent addition to Minnesota law. So that's why we're back this year trying to make this permanent. Early in the days of the pandemic, there was quite a bit of concern about, are you going to be able to get two witnesses in the same room? Lawyers have figured out ways to work around all of that. There's an extensive amount of case law related to Minnesota's witnessing requirements. Good lawyers know that stuff. We can coach our clients and figure out ways to make sure that the statutory witnessing requirements are met. The concern is more with COVID-related, more with people doing their own wills, doing their own witnessing, potentially doing it like we're doing now with Zoom, which is something, video witnessing has not been examined by our courts. So there were some issues like that. But again, we thought it was, a good overall permanent solution and a really cautious and fair approach that would deal with some particular problems but still have good long-term applicability. Now, you asked specifically, Representative Robbins, about having no witnesses. So I've done a lot of reading about these cases in other states, and I can tell you, and this is also the direction inside the Uniform Probate Code, is the further you drift from statutory requirements, the harder it is to meet the clear and convincing standard. So if you don't have any witnesses, that's a high bar to overcome. It's far more common for there to be, like I mentioned, witnesses signing on the wrong line or potentially one witness instead of two. I did read one case out of California where the witnesses didn't sign, but they were in the same room. They just, for whatever reason, didn't sign. And thinking about witnessing, there's actually a lawyer up in Duluth told me about a case that he had where he implemented this rule a few months ago. And in that particular case, the decedent had a pretty modest estate. He had a house and some cars and a bank account. And he had several siblings. He had no spouse, no kids. He wanted to leave his bank account money to one of his sisters and leave his house and his cars to some friends of his. Now, he executed a will, but he was in a care facility that only allowed one person in his room, so he had one witness instead of two. So without the harmless error rule, his will would have been invalid, and the intestacy statute would have dictated what happens to his assets, which meant it would have been divided amongst all his siblings, which was not what he wanted. So this came into the court, and the clear and convincing evidence that was offered, part of it was all of the decedent's siblings, the ones who otherwise would have inherited if his will was invalid, all said, no, this was what he intended. This was his will. This is exactly what he wanted, even though it's not good for us. Yes, potentially if there's only one witness or conceivably if there are no witnesses, although that's a very, very difficult standard to meet, it's potential that the harmless error rule could be applied. But I will note, too, as I mentioned earlier, Representative Robbins, for the average person, most of their assets or all of their assets can already be transferred outside of a will using other instruments that don't have any witnessing requirements whatsoever. I just went in my IRA the other day online and changed my beneficiary designations. All I did was log on and change them. So that's not to say witnessing requirements aren't important, but in some respects, they are a little bit antiquated, and most assets these days are transferring in non-probate transfer instruments or in revocable trust, neither of which have any witnessing requirements at all.
Thank you, Mr. Lake. Any follow-up, Representative Robbins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate that answer. It does help me feel better about this. I just have to say on the record that I really think this was always intended to be a COVID-related issue, and I'm concerned with just making it a permanent change, particularly because of the witness concerns I have. My concern, because I've seen it in my family growing up, is, you know, if one witness instead of two, it can be the witness who's the beneficiary, and that's, you know, problematic for other people. I'm glad the story you shared, it worked out, but there are plenty of examples where, you know, people manipulate this situation or the person to their benefit, and that's why I think the two witness part is very important. So anyway, thank you for the answers.
Madam Chair, could I just add one more thing?
Real quick, Mr. Lake.
Thank you. And to that, Representative Robbins, there's another case out of South Dakota kind of along the lines of what you said, where it was an interested party was the only witness. And in that case, the court rejected the application of the harmless error rule. So I think in some respects, we have to allow the courts here to have a little discretion to weigh the evidence in front of them and trust that that they're accustomed to doing that, as I mentioned, in all sorts of other types of probate error cases.
Right. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to weigh in or chime in as an attorney to say that I just think harmless error is good policy in general. And there are always situations where you know, justice might not be done. But I think that in general, and especially in this case where we're looking at this clear and convincing standard, that I just think it's good policy overall. And I do think that COVID, in the context of the judiciary and the legal systems, has given us an opportunity to look at the way we do things and maybe step forward in some ways. And I feel like this is one of those ways where the idea made a lot of sense in the context of COVID, and it just makes a lot of sense in general. In making sure, as Mr. Lake said, that regular people who this will mostly benefit will have their interests met by the system, by our legal systems. So thank you.
Great. Thank you, Representative Feist. Seeing no other hands, there were no amendments filed to this bill. Representative Long, any closing comments, or you just want to renew your motion?
I'll renew my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Long renews his motion that House Bill 279 be recommended to be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Becker Finn.
Aye.
Representative Moeller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grassl. Excuse. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Liebling.
Aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Representative Mortensen.
Aye.
Representative Novotny.
Aye.
Representative Farr.
Aye.
Representative Robbins.
Aye.
Representative Vang.
Aye.
Representative Zhang.
Aye.
We have 16 ayes.
Thank you. With that, the motion passes, and House Bill 279 is on its way to the general register. Thank you, members. That was an easier one to count, Anna, so good job. As a former committee legislative assistant, it's the most stressful thing with your job when you're on the record and having to go through the role. So I appreciate what a good job Anna does for us. With that, we'll move on to House File 403, which is Representative Herr's bill. 403 is regarding employers prohibited from inquiring about past pay. Representative Herr, would you like to move that House File 403 be recommended to be re-referred to the Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee?
Yes, that is my motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Herr moves her bill. Please go ahead, Representative Herr, and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm keenly aware that we only have 30 minutes left in committee. I know you're very good at stopping us at 10 o'clock, so we'll get through this quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This morning, I'm presenting House File 403, the Preventing Discrimination Act. This bill is very straightforward. It simply prevents an employer from asking what a job applicant's pay history is when they are negotiating salary. However, this bill does allow a job applicant to voluntarily disclose their pay history, and if they do so, an employer is allowed to use that information as necessary. But above all else, House File 403 takes us one step closer to closing the pay gap in Minnesota. The pay gap is very real in Minnesota. Women get paid 80 cents on the dollar for what a man makes, and this drop's even lower for women of color. I'm not going to speak to the stats today because I think we're all very familiar with that, so I'm just going to leave that part out of it in the interest of time. With House File 403, we work to close the pay gap, saying that a job applicant would no longer be forced to disclose the pay history during their salary negotiation. I know some of you may be naturally asking how that helps us close the pay gap, and it helps close the pay gap because the pay history question can give an employer a built-in excuse to pay a job applicant less because they're basing that decision solely off someone's pay history. So by ending the pay history question, a job applicant's future wage will no longer be anchored down by their past, and we can break the cycle of discrimination that can allow women and BIPOC sometimes through the entirety of their career. I just wanted to point out that it is important to note that 18 states, including Alabama and North Carolina, have already passed their own pay history question, and so it's time for Minnesota to do the same thing. Today, I do have two testifiers. The first is Professor Jill Hasday from the University of Minnesota Law School, who will give a historical deep dive into how the pay history question has perpetuated the pay gap, as well as Commissioner Lucero from the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. And so with that, I will turn it over to my first testifier, Professor Jill Hasday.
All right, Professor Hasday.
Thank you. Chair Becker-Finn and members of the committee, thank you for inviting me. My name is Jill Hasday. I'm a distinguished McKnight University professor and the Centennial Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. I teach and write about sex discrimination and constitutional law, among other subjects. In my time today, I want to make one simple but fundamental point. Asking about pay history perpetuates pay discrimination. I'm going to start with some historical background before describing the current state of the law and the need for legislative action. Before 1963, it was perfectly legal to pay women less. This type of discrimination was pervasive and out in the open. For instance, help wanted ads would list one salary for male workers and a lower salary for women performing the same jobs. Many hoped that the Federal Equal Pay Act of 1963 would end unequal pay between men and women. But 58 years after the law's enactment, an enormous wage differential persists. The median earnings for women working full-time and year-round in 2019 were just 82% of the median earnings for male full-time year-round workers, with Black women earning just 63% of white men's wages and Hispanic women earning just 55%. The latest studies estimate that the wage gap will not close for white women until 2055, for Black women until 2133, and for Hispanic women until 2220. One important reason for this wage gap is that employers frequently ask job applicants about their pay history before deciding what salary to offer. This widespread practice means that workers often cannot escape pay discrimination by getting a new job. If a woman's first boss pays her less than men earn for doing the same work, the consequences can reverberate for a lifetime. Discrimination early in a career can lock someone into a permanent cycle of unequal pay. Unfortunately, federal law does not prohibit employers from asking job applicants about their pay history. Instead, federal law accepts, even facilitates the practice. Employers sued under the Federal Equal Pay Act for paying women less will commonly defend their unequal pay practices by contending that they set salaries by relying on a job applicant's pay history. The United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit, which covers Minnesota, has accepted this argument, holding that it doesn't violate the Equal Pay Act for an employer to pay women less if the employer determined pay scales by relying on pay history. I'll repeat this because it's important. Federal law does not stop employers from paying women less for doing the exact same work as a man, so long as the employer can point to the woman's pay history as the basis for the discrimination. The ability to rely on pay history provides employers with a ready-made excuse for underpaying women, but efforts to amend federal law so far have been unsuccessful. A growing number of states and localities have responded to this problem by enacting their own laws to bar employers from questioning job applicants about pay history. These laws are aimed at ending the cycle of pay discrimination so everyone can receive equal pay for equal work. The laws benefit women and anyone else with a history of being underpaid. To date, approximately 18 states and 17 localities have prohibited employers from asking job applicants about their pay history. A 2020 study by researchers at Boston University School of Law found that the enactment of state pay history bans led more employers to list salaries in their online help wanted ads and increased pay for job changers by an average of 5%, with the pay of female job changers increasing by an average of 8%, and the pay of African-American job changers increasing by an average of 13%. In other words, adopting state pay history bans made workers as a whole better off while also reducing both gender and racial wage gaps. Minnesota should join this reform movement. Every Minnesotan deserves equal pay for equal work. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. We'll go to the next testifier, Commissioner Lucero. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi, good morning. Good morning, Chair Becker-Finn and members of the committee. Thanks for having me here today. I'm here today to speak on House File 403, the Preventing Pay Discrimination Act. This bill will help prevent discrimination from taking place when Minnesotans are applying for positions. Specifically, House File 403 prohibits an employer from asking an applicant to disclose their pay history from previous employment. This bill protects individuals who do not want to disclose information about their pay history. As Professor Housday laid out, racial and gender pay discrimination is historical, so we have to act with intention to end it. When women are paid less than men with similar experience, similar qualifications, and seniority for the same job, we have to look at what policies or practices, maybe formal, maybe informal, are existing that are perpetuating inequality in pay, resulting in this pay gap. So we have to be intentional, and House File 403 does just that. I'm not going to talk about the specific numbers for what women make compared to men for the purposes of time, but we know that across the board, women are making substantially less than men, and that's impacting women of color even more. We also know that Black, Latino, and Indigenous men also earn considerably less than white men. So to change this, we have to be intentional. Now, the use of the pay history question is one of the practices that is neutral on its face, but in practice, it causes inequality in pay. When future salaries are anchored to past pay, gender and racial pay discrimination can follow Minnesotans from job to job. This locks someone into a cycle of unequal pay, potentially throughout their entire career. So instead, relying on experience, skills, track record, and responsibilities of the position ensures pay discrimination doesn't occur in the first place. The Preventing Pay Discrimination Act would help break this cycle and can help stop pay discrimination from occurring. When Minnesota passes this bill, as we've heard, we will join a groundswell of states that have already ended the pay history question. States such as Alabama, Colorado, and North Carolina have all agreed that by ending the pay history question, we can take important steps to help close racial and gender pay gaps that exist. And Professor Hasday noted the report that was published by Boston University over the summer showing the pay history question ban works. In these states where that ban is in place, there was an 8% increase in pay for all women and a 13% increase in pay for Black workers. So we see by being intentional and eliminating the pay gap, families and children can better afford life's essentials like housing, healthcare, and education. I want to thank Representative Herr for authoring this bill and Chair Becker Finn and the committee for giving this critical bill a hearing. Our department is excited to support this bill and help Minnesota move one step closer to closing the pay gap. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got one more testifier on the list, so we'll go to the testifier and then to member questions. I have Mike Hickey, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony. Or not. Just looking at the list, I'm not sure if we have him signed in. So with that, we'll go to member questions. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Herr, for bringing this bill. I am really sympathetic. I want this bill to work. I, in my career in different areas, have received less pay than actually it was. In my experience, I was working a job and the person they hired after me, who happened to be a male, got more pay, even though I had been there longer and had the master's degree. So, you know, I have seen this in my own life. I know it's real. But my concern about this bill is the same one I had last year. And I'm honestly, you know, disappointed that it hasn't been addressed. And it's in line 1.11, where it says that the employer cannot even inquire into, consider, or require disclosure. And it's the word consider, honestly. Like, it's the word consider along with the rebuttable presumption that finds discrimination. I just feel like employers will be, I've also been an employer and had to hire and make difficult decisions. And if you cannot even consider pay history, like, even if you find it out through another channel, even if they voluntarily disclose it. Now, you give the freedom that if they voluntarily disclose it, then it's, but because of this rebuttable presumption and because of the word consider, I just feel like employers will be sort of damned if they do and damned if they don't. And I'm very concerned about the effect this will have. So I'm with you on the intent. I think this bill can get there, but I would like to see, I know there have been concerns expressed by the business community, and I think they were too late to file amendments, but I'm hoping we can continue to work on it. I would be happy to be part of working on it, but I'm very concerned that this will just lead to a lot of litigation because of the word consider, and then because of the rebuttable presumption, you know, it's really a tough hill to climb for employers. So I'd love you to speak to it. I'd especially like you to talk about how you think the rebuttal presumption will work in practice. Do any of the other states that have a pay equity bill also have that? I think it's, you know, a strong statement in the bill. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. I will also state for the record that the business community cannot file amendments. It would only be members of this committee that could file amendments. Representative Herr.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, Madam Chair. And I, when I saw this posted, I didn't see that it was posted very late Friday. I didn't even realize it was posted till Saturday. And I looked into it on Monday morning early, and it was too late. So I just want to say for the record, part of it is the timing. It was late. But no, I understand who actually files the amendments. Thank you.
Yeah, and I would recommend, you know, when we have an 8:30 a.m. Tuesday morning hearing, that was one of the reasons we pushed in the rules that the amendment deadline is 10 o'clock instead of 8:30. You know, many committees have 24-hour deadline, but we did want to give people that leeway. So I would encourage folks to check out the bills when they're posted on Thursday or sometime. You know, we'll post them as soon as we're able to. But did have some changes to what was available to be heard as far as committee reports moving things along. With that, we'll move on to Representative Long.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Could someone respond to my questions?
Oh, sorry about that. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can respond quickly. And Representative Robbins, I appreciate your concern. I remembered it from last year. I just wanted you to know that very late last night, I did reach out to the group that was going to testify today. They had a similar concern over that language. And I've actually been working with them, and I asked them, actually, they sent me some revisions probably 10 o'clock last night that I told them I would work with them on. So I hear your concerns. I do just want to say really quick that, you know, I don't see the issue with an employer not being able to consider this. I mean, employers do a lot of industry research to find out what pay ranges for certain types of jobs is, but they often use that to tell somebody why they have to get paid within that range. And so they are already collecting their own data to tell somebody what it is they believe somebody should get paid for a certain type of job. There are best practices in HR, human capital management, organizational management that actually guides a lot of this work. And that if somebody then were really looking at a candidate and seeing who is the most qualified for it, they would be basing the salary based on the information they'd gather, which they always tell us is industry practices, which we do at the legislature when we look at to hire jobs. And that then they base it on the person's experience, how they interviewed when they came in, the questions that are asked by that employer, and then they base the salary based on that. So truthfully, considering the salary from the past, that word does not concern me because I know what it is that companies do. I've worked for 15 years in the private sector where I hired people. And there are many, many processes and procedures in place in which that's why we don't disclose our pay ranges because we really don't want people to know, right? And so there are a lot of mechanisms in place that shift the balance of power with the employer. So I'm not concerned as much about that specific language piece of it. I don't know if one of my other testifiers, Commissioner Lucero, has anything else to add to that.
Commissioner Lucero.
Yeah, thank you so much, and thanks for the question. I do want to clarify that this is covered in detail. We did hear this concern, and it is covered as part of Subdivision 8C. Nothing in this subdivision shall prevent an applicant for employment from voluntarily and without prompting disclose pay history for the purposes of negotiating wages. So absolutely, if an applicant would like to disclose their own pay history, they are welcome to do so. The point is that something that they can choose to keep private and shouldn't be considered at the end of the day in the conversation on how much somebody's getting paid.
Thank you, Commissioner Lucero. And we do have four people on the list to weigh in. So we'll move to Representative Long next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick comment and then a question. I just wanted to note that I think this bill does to strike what seems to me to be precisely the right balance between allowing an employee to present their salary history if they want it to be negotiated, but not allowing an employer to use it on the front end, which I think creates all the problems that we've heard from witnesses and that I've observed when I've done hiring practices in the past. Is one thing I wanted to ask about is I know that for caregiving or people who take time out of the workforce, certainly there are some men who do that, but my understanding is still the great majority of folks who take time off to care for kids and then reenter the workforce are women. And if you were simply looking at salary history that might be dated from before they took time off for work or looked at their immediate employment history, that would conceivably significantly impact, I think, the salary for somebody who's getting rehired after a break. And I'm curious if that's been looked into or if there's data on how that impacts people getting rehired when they're entering the workforce.
Representative Herr.
Thank you, Representative Long. And I'll just speak really quickly to that. Maybe one of my other testifiers can as well. But we do know, I think I might have mentioned this before, that my doctorate dissertation is actually on advancement in pay of women of color. And we do have data that show that because women are still primary the caregiver, that when they do return to the workforce, that does have an impact on their pay and that they almost never come back at the same pay in which they left the workforce in. And so I'm just going to leave it at that since my dissertation is very long. And so I'm going to let one of my other testifiers speak in case they have something else to add.
I'm not sure which one of you wants to take it, but go ahead.
I agree. That's another problem. I mean, and maybe something I could say is this bill alone is an important step forward, but it's not the only step forward, right? The wage gap is this enormous problem, and this is one of the steps. Discrimination also against women who leave the workforce, and I think they're overly penalized. That's maybe that could be another legislative agenda, but I think they're all of a piece. They all kind of the same direction.
All right, thank you. Next we have Representative Johnson.
Chair Beckerfin, members, I do have a wonder if Representative Kerr could clarify a few things. To start with, this isn't for her, but this is for the chair. We were advised about this bill coming up at, I believe it was 8:33 on Friday night. And we had a number of our members reach out to different groups. And by the time they were actually able to get into it and talk to their members and get a consensus on it, it was too late for the amendment deadline because it was so short time period, 10 o'clock Monday morning. By the time they can get together, it's 8 o'clock Monday morning, and 2 hours is not enough time to put things together. So it's unfortunate of the timing of when this bill was added. But we did, after the deadline, Minnesota Employment Law Council provided some information, and I'm wondering if Representative Herr could answer some of the questions they have and the concerns they have. One of them is in lines 1.23 to 2.2, subpart C, the phrase without prompting disclosure. That could be likely result in confusion and dispute over whether a particular discussion or inquiry somehow prompted a pay history, and that could create all sorts of headaches. Also in subpart C, the Minnesota Employment Legal Council proposes that if an employee voluntarily discloses her pay history, that information may be used in the party's negotiations without limitation, regardless whether an offer was previously presented. There's a couple other current concerns that they have with this bill, and I'm wondering if you could just answer that part of it, because it is very confusing whether somebody volunteered to give it or was prompted. And what you're forcing this into is all these meetings and stuff being recorded, keeping that information for how many years before they can actually dispose of it, because the number of years that they have to bring legal action. So I think I like the concept of this bill, but until those issues are taken care of, it's going to be very difficult to vote for this bill.
So first I want to say that, the notice went out 4.5 days before this hearing, and, it can be a challenge sometimes to keep up with the work that we have to do here, but, it comes with the job during session. And so I will note the frustration, but I can also say that I didn't hear personally not one single person, elected or otherwise reached out to me with any concerns about this bill ahead of time at any point until the hearing today. Representative Herr, if you want to go forward to answer Representative Johnson's questions.
Thank you, Chair Beckerfin, and thank you for the questions, Chair Representative Johnson. So I do just want to add that this bill was carried by Chair Moran and also Chair Mahoney and other bienniums, and so this bill is not a new bill. This has been out there for a really long time, and yet we have not heard concerns until right up to, hours before this bill was heard. I am very aware of MELC's concerns. I actually received the concerns at 7:30 last night. I talked to them, called them, received revisions from them later that evening as well. And so I'm just to be aware that I've actually talked to the commissioners at the Department of Human Rights around a couple of these bullet points that we are saying we absolutely would look at the language and see any adjustments that could be made. And so I know you are concerned, Representative Johnson, but we have made a commitment to Molly, who I spoke with, who was representing MELC, that we will work with them on this bill language. I do just want to address a specific bullet point of 1.23 to 2.22. I specifically asked them, well, what does prompted mean? And I was given an example that it was really didn't I wasn't given any concrete example of what would be ambiguous about what prompting meant. And so I said, what I need is some concrete language changes that they would like to see, and not just that, well, just take it out completely. And so I agree with your concerns, but I am working directly with them because I want to address the issue and not just then either get rid of the bill or the language itself because people don't like it. It is about as ambiguous as somebody was prompted, as ambiguous as when a woman says no means no. And so to me, it is not ambiguous in that way. And if they could find better language for me to include, I absolutely will consider it.
Thank you, Representative Herr. We've got one more question, and we do have a hard stop today. It's the virtual equivalent of having to get out of the room for Rules Committee. So, Representative Scott. Representative Scott, I think you're muted.
There we go. Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Herr, for this bill. And when I voted for it last year or a year before, I don't remember which, I did vote for it with reservations, and I do have a few questions. One is, I don't think the issue of the rebuttable presumption has been really addressed, and I don't know if this question is for the bill's author or for the commissioner, but do other areas of employment law and discrimination law have a rebuttable presumption, and what do other states have a rebuttable presumption? And my other question has to do with what if somebody is already an employee of a company, and so that the person doing the interview already knows what that person is making, what their current salary is, how is that handled?
Representative Herr.
I do know the answer to those questions. Thank you, Representative Scott. But I'm going to let the commissioner, she can probably be more succinct around what other states are doing around that.
Commissioner Lucero.
Great. Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. Thank you for the question, Peggy Scott. So I'm sorry, Representative Scott. So first and foremost, a really good example of prompting disclosure is somebody writing right on the application itself and saying, what is your current wage? That's an example of a prompt. And it might be helpful to note that there are many, many questions that HR professionals and employers, I do every single day, I am prohibited from asking because we know they lead to discriminatory outcomes. For instance, you cannot ask, are you pregnant? Are you going to become pregnant? Are you married? Are you going to be spending time with your family? So this is just adding to a long list of questions that we already don't ask because we want to make sure that we have better outcomes when it comes to gender and race discrimination. And we know this pay gap exists, and so we need to change that. I am going to have to get back to you on some other areas. Oh, what I do want to say is that there every single state has similar versions of the pay history question ban, and there are two. That they have nuances, but they have two basic components over and over again. First is that they prohibit employers to ask about pay history, and second, they allow job applicants to voluntarily disclose. And that is exactly what's laid out in this bill. A couple of the other details, Representative Herr has made the commitment to work with folks to see if we can change any of the language. Thank you.
So, Madam Chair.
Yeah, real quick, Representative Scott.
I didn't hear an answer to the rebuttable presumption question, and I don't know if House Research would have that, or maybe the bill's author can speak to that, but I think Representative Robbins sort of asked that question. It wasn't answered, and I know, Representative Herr, you're going to be working on this, and I appreciate that. I just wanted that answer to kind of be addressed if possible, and you can do it offline.
Yeah, Representative Herr, I would ask you to work with the commissioner and others so that that information can be provided to the committee, and would encourage you to have an answer to that question before you have a hearing in the next committee. So with that, will Representative Herr renews her motion that House File 403 be recommended to be re-referred to the Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Beckerfin.
Aye.
Representative Mueller.
Aye.
Representative Scott.
Yes, with reservation.
Representative Feist.
Aye.
Representative Frazier.
Aye.
Representative Grossel, excused. Representative Herr.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
No, not in the current form.
Representative Liebling?
Enthusiastically, yes.
Representative Long?
Aye.
Representative Mortensen?
No.
Representative Novotny?
Yes.
Representative Farr?
No.
Representative Robbins?
No, but I look forward to voting for it later.
Representative Vang?
Aye.
Representative Zhang?
Aye.
I have 12 ayes and 4 noes.
All right, the motion passes. I will remind members, it's you got two options. It's aye or no. It makes it much easier on our staff if you just stick to that moving forward. So with that, House File 403 is recommended be referred to the Labor, Industry, Veterans, and Military Affairs, Finance, and Policy Committee. And thank you, members, for the good discussion today. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.